Good morning. My name is Maureen Sear. I represent James Schumacher, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, prejudicial evidentiary errors require that the conviction for second-degree murder be reversed. In addition, because the statutory aggravator relied upon by the state to impose the exceptional sentence is unconstitutionally vague and the state did not present evidence to prove the aggravator beyond a reasonable doubt, the exceptional sentence must be reversed. I would like to focus on one of the evidentiary issues, which is the trial court's decision to admit Gene Schumacher's out-of-court statements expressing fear of Mr. Schumacher. And I did want to clarify something that may not be completely clear in the briefing, which is that we're challenging all of her statements of fear, all of her out-of-court statements of fear, those made to her daughter Susan Schumacher, as well as those that she made to the medical providers following the incident that occurred in November 2010. And those were objected to by defense counsel.
What do we do with the defense theory of diminished capacity and Dr. Beaver's testimony when he's describing how he arrives at his conclusions, that he's taking into consideration the history of the tumultuous relationship, the allegations of mutual threats to kill over the years? Doesn't that inherently include the emotion back and forth between the parties? Isn't that what the trial court was relying on when it ruled this evidence could come in?
The trial court ruled that her statements expressing fear of Mr. Schumacher were admissible because they were relevant to the issue of intent. But it's clear in the case law that if the decedent in a murder case, if the decedent's expressions of fear of the defendant are relevant only to intent, and in Parr, the Washington Supreme Court acknowledged that the decedent's statements of fear of the defendant may be relevant to intent, but if that's their only relevance, then they are not admissible. This kind of evidence is just too damaging, too prejudicial. The potential for misuse of the evidence as well as the potential to fabricate this kind of evidence requires that it be excluded.
Even if the defense theory touches on the same components?
Defense theory, the defense did not put Ms. Schumacher's state of mind at issue. It may have put the prior disputes, the prior conflict between the parties at issue, but it did not put her state of mind. I mean, at the time of the event, the evidence seems to show that Ms. Schumacher was asleep or did not, her state of mind was not at issue in, as to what, the defense did not argue that her state of mind caused her to act in a particular way that was relevant to the defense.
Right, but the defense theory of diminished capacity is you got to look at this whole picture and arriving at deciding what level of stress he was under and the whole circumstances of this relationship. Doesn't that inherently include open the door, if that's the terminology?
To her state of mind? I don't think
so. To the interaction between the two of them, including the emotional state, the stress levels of both of them back and forth.
I don't think the case law supports that. I don't believe there's any authority that says that her state, her expressions of fear or her state of mind is at issue in this murder case just because he presented a defense of diminished capacity. I believe that in the case that we relied on, State v. Cameron, the defense also was either diminished capacity or insanity. So in that case, the court held that that defense did not put the decedent's state of mind and whether or not she feared the defendant at issue. And here, again, keep in mind that these expressions of fear of the defendant were made about a year and a half before the incident. So even if Ms. Schumacher was afraid of Mr. Schumacher at that time, the defense is that he had a degenerative condition that caused him to, his state of mind at the time of this particular incident was different than his state of mind had been in the past during their quarrels. And because this evidence was highly prejudicial, it requires that the conviction be reversed. Ms. Schumacher's statements, especially the one she allegedly made to her daughter, was very inflammatory, It undermined the defense that Mr. Schumacher was acting out of character and on the date of the incident. And just briefly, in my remaining time, I would like to address the aggravator, the state's failure to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was an ongoing pattern of psychological or physical abuse. The state was required to prove that this offense was part of an ongoing pattern of psychological or physical abuse manifested by multiple incidents over a prolonged period of time. We believe that this requires the state to prove that there were actual individual incidents and not just and could not just simply rely on statements such as either Mr. Schumacher's or Ms. Schumacher's statements that there was abuse. So there were some conclusory statements in the record that there was abuse, but there needs to be more. There needs to be proof of actual individual incidents of abuse. In regard to physical abuse, the only evidence presented was that 2010 incident. And during that incident, Ms. Schumacher made statements alleging that there had been prior physical abuse without really specifying what that was. She did say that Mr. Schumacher had hit her and shoved her before, but that was a very vague allegation. I don't believe that that evidence reaches a level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of a pattern of physical abuse. And as for psychological abuse, it seems to be the only evidence presented of that was the evidence that Mr. Schumacher had, over the course of their marriage, they had a lot of screaming fits, apparently. He called her names. He yelled at her often, but it seems that she also yelled back at him. There was a lot of back and forth disputes. There's no proof of actual harm from the alleged psychological abuse, and it appears to be that it was just sort of an inherent part of their relationship. And altogether, this evidence does not rise to proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the ongoing pattern of psychological or physical abuse. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington and the respondent in this case. The defendant bludgeoned his wife to death with a hatchet and then confessed in a very detailed confession, went to trial with a diminished capacity defense, and was convicted of a lesser charge of murder, too, with the aggravator. There are two specific aspects of this appeal, the challenge to the conviction based on evidentiary grounds and the challenge to the aggravator based on vagueness grounds. I want to make just two initial comments first. I do read all of this court's opinions, including unpublished opinions. The Baldwin says you cannot challenge the aggravator on vagueness grounds. I've looked at all those opinions, the judges that wrote those opinions. I see nothing new. I do not intend to discuss the aggravator at this point. In terms of the evidentiary issues, I believe the trial court was correct in all of its evidentiary rulings. But I would say this, the evidence was such in this case, and the mental defense was such in this case, that even if the trial court was incorrect, it was harmless. The history of abuse of these parties was already before the jury through the defendant's multiple confessions or statements that he made, and that includes multiple statements he made to the mental health care, I won't call them providers, the expert witnesses that took statements from him. And the mental defense itself was incredulous. Dr. Beaver, the defense expert, said he could form intent when he woke up that morning with the idea that he was going to go scare his wife. He could form the intent when he went to the garage and obtained a hatchet. He could form the intent when he went to her room and picked the lock on her bedroom door. He could form the intent when he was standing over her as she was sleeping in her bed. But then Dr. Beaver says at this very precise moment, when he took the first swing of the hatchet to her head, somehow at that point he wasn't able to form intent because he had mild dementia, supposedly, the flu, and improperly managed diabetes and a history of a failed marriage. There is no reasonable probability that these minor evidentiary claims could have affected the verdict in this case. But let me talk specifically about the victim's expressions of fear that were made about 16 months prior to her murder. This is simply a question of relevance and probative versus prejudicial value under 401, 402, and 403. Does this evidence have any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequences to this action more or less probable? And it certainly does. And let's not forget, this is within the sound discretion of the trial court. For the defendant to prevail, they have to show that no reasonable judge would have found this evidence probative. And I think one of the things that this court simply has to ask is, what was the full nature of the relationship? I mean, how did that the nature of the relationship contribute to his motive and his intent to commit murder? How did it contribute to his mental state?
How does her fear impact any analysis of his level of stress?
Well, I think the court simply has to ask a couple questions, because defense wants to divorce itself and say, we're simply looking at her state of mind, and that's different from the nature of the relationship. Well, you can't do that, because all you have to do is look at the fact, what was the nature of the relationship? Was Jean, the victim, constantly nagging the defendant, and he never responded, and his anger was building? Did she have no fear whatsoever and just thought he was a blowhard, or was he in fear of her, her in fear of him?
Why isn't it adequate, though, to address what the conduct was, what the statements were, the context of those? Why do you need to get into her emotional state?
It's not a question of need. It's a question, because, again, this is up to the trial court's discretion. The trial court could easily said, well, just what you're saying, you have this other evidence, you don't necessarily need this, so I'm finding that although it is relevant, it's overly prejudicial. The court could have found that way, but the court did not, because it's within the court's discretion. Yes?
Mr. McCurdy, doesn't the record show that both of these individuals said they were going to kill him, her, over and over again? So, I mean, the jury already knew that and already heard that. So is there more prejudice because it came from the daughter repeating what her mother said?
Well, what you're referring to is the defendant's statement in himself. I think that's the only place where that came in, where there were threats to kill back and forth. He told that to Dr. Beaver. I don't believe there's any evidence from the state's witnesses, meaning the son, the daughter, the medical records, that there were threats to kill that went back and forth. I also don't believe there was any other evidence specifically of fear as stated by the victim. There's actual acts that would suggest that, because this arose out of the time that she was assaulted and taken to the hospital.
Well, she locked the door night of this incident.
Yes. No, I'm referring back a little bit back in time. When this actually occurred, he was arrested, removed from the house. She went ahead and got a protection order. She moved out of the house briefly. And then ultimately she, in fact, as the classic domestic violence, lets him back in. So you also, at that exact same time where she expressed fear, you have all of this evidence that she actually had some fear. And that goes to the aspect of this evidence wasn't particularly probative. Wasn't particularly prejudicial either.
How did the state argue it to the jury, that the aspect that we're talking about now, the victim's fear?
I don't
pull it out and argue it, or just
no. It wasn't a prominent aspect of this case in closing, because the prominent aspect, of course, was the mental defense, because he gave a detailed confession, a detailed statement, and literally the entire closing focused on the. I'll use a polite word, how incredulous the Dr. Beaver's testimony was that he couldn't form intent because of the flu and mild dementia. And yet he could, as Dr. Beaver said, possess the intent all the way except the first blow when he strikes her in the head and says, well, he knew what he was doing, but he really couldn't stop himself. I mean, that was Dr. Beaver's testimony. And that's what all of this trial focused on, because the defense, quite frankly, they had nothing else. You had such a detailed confession. You had all of the evidence at the scene supporting the confession. The only defense was to try and manufacture a mental defense.
The trial court floated the idea that some either party could ask for a limiting instruction related to the fear. Did either side propose a limiting instruction?
There was a limiting instruction given in the jury instructions at the end. It is broadly written. I believe I actually wrote it down here. It is instruction number nine, CP61, and it just talks about evidence of the prior verbal disputes and physical acts between the defendant and victim can be considered only for the purposes of whether the defendant acted with premeditated intent, or whether the offense was an aggravated DV offense.
And really wouldn't apply to the fear.
Well, I think you could argue that's covered within that, and I don't think the state certainly did not go beyond the purpose of the admission of that evidence and somehow argue.
Did any witness testify as to whether he had a diminished capacity at the time of the event 16 months before?
No. The defense tried to cut off any evidence of prior hostility or disputes prior to 6 months before the murder, because that's when he told Dr. Beaver.
Did the defense expert testify as to when the incapacity leading to a diminished capacity took root? Was it sometime between 16 months before and when the hatchet first fell, or what? Was there any testimony?
Well, you've got two different questions. The incapacity was only, as he said, for a moment in time. It was only at the time of the blow. He specifically said he was not incapacitated in terms of forming intent all the way up until then. So there's no incapacity whatsoever in terms of forming intent except when he swings the first blow. That's what Dr. Beaver says. Now, the other side of that question is, when did the factors that come into forming that lack of ability to have intent happen? And he talked about a variety of things, like the failure to take the diabetes medication, which occurred 6 months prior, according to the defendant. But he specifically said that the whole nature of their relationship, all of it, played a role in creating the stress level that triggered his incapacity at the time he killed her. Unless there's no further questions, I'd ask you guys to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes.
Okay. Again, it's not correct to say that it's simply a question of relevance, whether or not the evidence of Ms. Schumacher's fear of Mr. Schumacher was admissible. In Parr, the court explicitly said, even if the evidence is relevant to the defendant's intent, it's still not admissible. The court set out a special rule in that case for murder cases that the decedent's expressions of fear of the defendant are not admissible unless the decedent's state of mind is specifically put at issue by the defense raised. If the defense is making some argument about how the victim acted in a particular manner, and therefore the victim's state of mind is maybe relevant to explain why or whether the decedent acted in that particular manner. I guess I would also disagree that the diminished capacity defense was not credible. I think that the jury gave it some credence. The state argued that this was a premeditated murder. The state charged premeditated murder, arguing that Mr. Schumacher had the intent to kill when he picked up the hatchet, when he broke into the room. But the jury rejected or at least did not decide the premeditated intent issue, and instead found Mr. Schumacher guilty of second-degree murder, finding that he had an intent to kill at the time of the act of his actions, but not a premeditated intent. And I think that part of that is due to the diminished capacity defense. Unless the court has any further questions, again, we would ask that the court reverse the conviction for second-degree murder as well as the exceptional sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Next up.